All right, we're going to get started. Thank you all for attending the 2020 Sunstone Digital Symposium, session 234, titled Growing Out of Evergreen. The audio from this session will be available for purchase at sunstone.org after the symposium. The video recording of this session will be available in the Whova app for the remainder of 2020. The question and answer section will follow the presentation, and you can type your questions into the Whova app to be addressed during the Q&A section. At Sunstone, we are making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our tagline is, "There is more than one way to Mormon." We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. Please support us in our mission by making a donation and subscribing to sunstone.org. Now about this presentation. This discussion follows two men from different areas around the globe as they explore their upbringing in the church as gay men trying to overcome their sexuality in church-sponsored programs like Evergreen. I'll take a second to introduce you to our speakers before we begin. Born in Provo, while parents were attending BYU, Jan Curran, pronounced Jan, from Danish Mormon pioneer ancestry, was raised Mormon by devout but eccentric parents. Mother Elmary from Idaho, first class of BYU's nursing school, and father Grenade, a B-movie actor and producer from Hollywood. Jan served a mission to Japan, graduated BYU with a BA in international relations, served as elders quorum president in two wards, gospel doctrine instructor in three wards, was married in the Salt Lake Temple, and had two kids with his now ex-wife, Krista Johansson, and had a foster son as a single man, and all the while struggling with internal self-loathing and cognitive dissonance over his sexual orientation. Jan completed an MBA/MIM from Thunderbird in Arizona and worked in international banking for several years. He served in leadership in Evergreen in the 1990s, chairing two annual conferences and presenting more than 100 devotionals, workshops, conferences, sacrament meetings, etc., bearing his testimony of the Mormon Church and his belief that faith in Jesus would heal him. His faith crisis started in 2008 with the Prop 8 debacle in California. He stayed active until 2013, then resigned. He's currently working baby steps to restore his lost relationship with his two youngest kids who disavowed him after the church's November 2015 policy regarding homosexuals, and their children became public. His daughter is on a mission in Germany, and his son just graduated high school in Utah. Dr. Ken McFadden was a convert to the church at age 15. Coming from an impoverished background, the church provided him an opportunity to learn new skills and to find confidence to see the world outside of his narrow-focused environment. He served a mission in Birmingham, England, and underwent 18 months of reparative therapy, beginning a few months following his mission return. He married and had two children whilst studying a bachelor's degree in psychology. On completion, Ken felt a growing need to live an authentic life as an openly gay man. He soon after trained to be a clinical psychologist and has been working in practice for over 16 years. His personal and professional experience gives Ken a perspective on reparative therapy that is both personal and scholarly. I'll now give the floor over to our presenters.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Daniel.
I'm kind of not used to doing this kind of thing, so I don't know what people can see, what they can't. I'm hoping that people can see. I'm hoping that there are people listening, actually, or watching. Jan and I have met just one time online, and we had a conversation about how we wanted this to go, and we thought it would be a good idea if we just spent 5 or so minutes introducing ourselves, and then having a conversation with each other about our experiences, and then finally finishing off with some questions that you all might have. Jan, are you happy to start with an introduction of yourself?
Sure, although that little introduction that Daniel read, I think kind of covers it generally, but let me just get into it. Latter-day Saints and atheists top the list of lay people with the highest scriptural familiarity, but I have long felt that LDS Church continues to feed its members pablum in order to dumb us down to be obedient, and that's unfortunate. I was in my 20s when at BYU, I apologize for that. Let me turn that off. There, it's off. And I just decided to delve into Hugh Nibley's books. I took two of his Pearl of Great Price classes, and then I was delving into the mysteries of the scriptures and the history of the LDS Church. And the more that I found, the more that I respect I had for Joseph Smith, though some things of the Book of Mormon are still not believable to me, his faults and his uniqueness made me respect him more. I loved that in Orson Scott Card's novel Saints, that Joseph was a man who took his shirt off and sweated and went to the outhouse and stank. He was just a human. I generally wanted to be the church's next Hugh Nibley, a scholar who could bring to life the LDS Church's history, the scriptures, both ancient and modern, as well as archaeology, etc. So I studied ancient Greek, Hebrew, Egyptian hieroglyphics, hieratic and demotic. I studied the Mayan and the languages of North Africa and took classes in archaeology at BYU. I joined a semi-monthly study group of adults attempting to learn more in depth about the ancient roots of the gospel. Back then, Neil Maxwell was an apostle, and he wrote about us in a book that he called We Talk of Christ. A few months later in General Conference, the general authorities came down severely on study groups who in their eyes were promoting anti-Mormon beliefs, because of course many of us were associated with the historians that were getting into trouble. But it's unfortunate because I felt we were all faithful in our efforts to be good Mormons and to learn more about what the truth was. I was being guided in those groups by a few scholars. Back then, D. Michael Quinn, Andrew F. E. Hatt, Harry Russell, Dean Jesse, Avram Gileadi, and others. I read books by Barry Fell and Ivan J. Barrett. Some of you may remember that Ivan Barrett wrote the Institute coursework text for LDS Church history during the Joseph Smith period. Yigal Yadin, who of course wrote about the temple. And I studied the Anthem transcripts and the Salamander letters, which of course now have been deemed forgeries by Mark Hoffman. I went to the church's archives in the vault in the Little Cottonwood Canyon, as they were still open to the public back then, until Mark Hoffman's debacles, which caused the church to close down even tighter on those documents. The more that I found that I might cause questions about the LDS Church, the stronger my faith was. But the more that the church excommunicated people and removed access to those archives and to those documents, the more and more that they spoke out against deeper study, the more betrayed I felt by the church. My faith dwindled, but this was a process that took 25 years before I finally admitted that I no longer believed in the church. There was no real one event which started me on the road, but I came head to head. Oh, sounds like somebody's talking. Anyway, what I knew about homosexuality and the preachings of the LDS Church finally came to a head with one seminal event, which took place in 2008 in California, the months-long political battle to pass Proposition 8, which reversed a previous California law allowing gay marriage. Because of the LDS Church's involvement and subsequent revelations about tax filings and deception on the part of the church, which led to state charges filed by the California State Election Board, for which the church has paid a $15,000 fine, and federal charges filed by the IRS, which are still pending in federal court, by the way, my hurt and my anger was kindled, and those events finally opened the door for me to start reevaluating my beliefs and examine closely some of the basic tenets of the LDS doctrine. Until the spring of 2008, I was still an active temple recommend holding believing Latter-day Saint. I was no longer involved in Evergreen leadership, but I was kind of keeping tacit finger control and access back then. This was right around the time that Evergreen started to diminish in its influence and eventually was taken over by North Star. That's kind of the basic gist for me, and I'll turn it over to Ken.
Thank you, Jan. So I'm broadcasting, huh? That's a bit grandiose. I'm speaking here from a village in England called Inkborough. It's in the very heart of the English countryside. and is very picturesque and very what you would imagine England to be like. It's very green and it's very lush and it's very pretty. But those are certainly not my roots. My roots are from a town in Scotland called Paisley. People might know it from the Paisley pattern because that's where it originated and that's the town's claim to fame. My background is actually, without kind of getting violins out, it's actually a very impoverished background where, you know, I've suffered a lot of physical abuse as a child and sometimes hunger and neglect. And I guess because of those experiences that I had as a child, I had a yearning, if you want, or definitely a strong desire to want to be different. I've had my background kind of dictated how my life went. So one day I noticed that there were some Mormon missionaries knocking around in the houses in the street where I was in. And I told my mum that if they knocked on our door, that I'd be really happy to speak to them. So consequently, they knocked on my door and, you know, they went through the message of the missionary discussions. And actually, I kind of fell for that hook, line, and sinker. It was presented in such a way that was so believable and so full of hope for me that it really lit a fire in me that wasn't lit anywhere else in my life. And I learned things about myself in the church that I would not have learned anywhere else from my background. So, you know, probably the first time in my life I was treated as special. So I was a golden convert. So the missionaries treated me really special. The ward members welcomed me with open arms. And again, I was treated really special. Then I kind of thought myself as a little bit special too, because I was the only Mormon in my high school. So I thought I was something pretty good. Unfortunately, that didn't last, but I'll come to that. I learned that, in the church that I was a kind of bit of a natural leader, actually, which wouldn't have come to me otherwise. I learned that I could undertake any calling that was given to me. I was young men's president for a long time. I've been on the bishopric when I was 25. High priest from a very young age. Missionary work was exciting to me. Interestingly, actually, where I live now is actually in the heart of my old mission area, so I'm very, very familiar with with where I am. So my kind of story begins really after my mission. I always knew that I was gay. I was attracted to men, but I didn't really cotton on to the severity of kind of how the church viewed that for a very long time. And when it kind of started to dawn on me, I was quite uncomfortable about it. But to be honest, you know, this was the late 80s. And actually the church's view on being gay and being homosexual wasn't very dissimilar to 80s attitudes here in the UK anyway. So I kind of just thought, I can get by with this. I can just bury it like I've been burying it anyway. So I went on a mission. Came home, and when I came home, my best friend was killed in a road traffic accident. And that really caused me a lot of introspection, and I really thought that actually if that had been me, I would not be able to be let into the celestial kingdom because of this dark secret that I carried about myself. So I approached my bishop and was referred to social services. LDS social services here in the UK, and they ran a program that was very under the auspices of Evergreen, that was essentially what I know now to be called reparative therapy. I was the perfect patient. As a clinical psychologist, I look back on myself and I cringe about how easy I was really for my therapist, but that's another story too. I've got to kind of be honest here at this point that the reparative therapy that I had in the UK, it was nowhere near as harsh and it was nowhere near as severe as accounts that I have read from the USA. I had weekly therapy sessions. I had monthly visits with my bishop. for progress. And, you know, it was all about, it was a little bit like, if you've seen the film, what's it called now? Oops, sorry, I've just profanity there. Boy Erased, that's it. It was a bit like that. I went to group therapy, I went to individual therapy. And fortunately, because this was in the UK, when I got to a point where I decided that I was done with this, it was very easy for me to leave Mormonism, because Mormonism is so minuscule here that there are so many other avenues open to me. Anyway, after reparative therapy, I really kind of, you know, took to like a duck to water, did everything that I thought that I should do. Really felt that I was on top of things, really felt that I was on top of my sexuality and that it wouldn't be a problem for me. And I started dating a really beautiful woman who became my wife. And we had two beautiful children. And during this time, I was studying psychology. So I don't want to kind of keep, a note on time here, because I could go on and on about this, but I won't. And basically, after I finished my degree, I found it very, very difficult, more and more difficult, not to be authentic and to be who I actually was. And, you know, at the time of this realization, I guess I was actually, it was so hard for me to cope with that I now realize that I actually was going through a mental breakdown and was becoming suicidal. And actually, as awful as those feelings were to be, want to be dead, because I thought it was probably better that my children have a dead father than a gay father. That really was a turning point for me, because it really made me question whether that was actually true. Is it really true that children are better off with a dead father than a gay father? And that was a fantastic turning point for me. From that point, I came out, and I, you know, marriage ended, and, you know, haven't lived happily ever after by any means, but most certainly much, much happier being authentic and being myself than if I had chosen to remain, you know, active in the Mormon Church. Now, an interesting twist was that my 13-year-old son came out later, and I was really pleased that I was able to be there to support him through that. Later, my daughter kind of disavowed the church because she couldn't understand why her father and her brother and her father's partner, you know, were these terrible, heinous people, that she only ever knew loved her and supported her unconditionally. So I've been out of the church now for 20 years. It's quite a small part of my life, and actually I'm only really associated with the church because of Affirmation, and I'm the UK president chapter at the moment for that, and hope to kind of give back in a bit of a way through my professional training, you know, and people who are struggling perhaps to negotiate the line between the church and sexuality. Thank you.
Well, you raised a whole lot of stuff, and I want to join back into the conversation, but a couple things I wanted to start with was a lot of people have a misconception about what Evergreen was. Many times, I would say at least a minimum of once or twice a week, I get someone who says that, oh yeah, Evergreen was where they did electroshock therapy, or Evergreen was where reparative therapy was performed. And I'm like, no, those are all not true. Those are misconceptions about what Evergreen was. So let me just give a quick overview. 1989, nine men who lived in the Salt Lake area got together, and all of them struggled with what they felt were same-sex attraction. Now, that term same-sex attraction was created by therapists working with these nine men who were all associated with the LDS social services back then. Now it's called family and something else, but these nine men were looking for a way to help each other, kind of in a way like AA serves the alcoholic community. No therapy is done at AA meetings, just like there's no therapy done at Evergreen. It was not a place where therapy was done, but they did discuss some of those therapies and counsels, and counselors were given referrals through the Evergreen group. So these nine guys started. I got involved in 1992 after I had attempted suicide, and I, like Ken, had struggled with my self-esteem issues and self-loathing and years of unhappiness, because I felt like these attractions that I had were just so disgusting, and the church didn't want or approve it, and God certainly looked horribly on me. And so I had attempted suicide, and finally had to tell my mother that I was attracted to men. And so she went out, and she has a bachelor's degree in nursing and a master's in clinical psychology. And so she had some feelers in the community here in Salt Lake, in the health community. And someone in her work at the Salt Lake Health Department told her about Evergreen. And back then, Evergreen was only 2.5-3 years old. And so she volunteered herself to be on the board. And within a matter of a few months, she was not only serving on the board, but she was leading the parents group. And this would be kind of like a PFLAG. Instead of supporting gay kids as gay, she was helping these parents support their kids as good Mormons. And that's essentially what the mission of Evergreen was. These men wanted to stay good Mormons. And so as time went on and Evergreen grew with more and more people throughout the 90s, Ken, you said you'd joined or you'd gotten hold of Evergreen. I'm not quite sure when that was. It would have been in the 90s, right? Because it didn't start until 89.
It was 1993.
Yeah, well, I started associating with Evergreen in 92, so just a year before you.
So if you don't mind, Jan, I'll just jump in for a second. The term reparative therapy actually came around in 1983, and it was actually an English psychologist who coined the term. It was based on some Freudian drives about repairing relationships where there is a void.
Yeah, and that was actually expanded upon by Elizabeth Moberly and Joseph Nicolosi in that
It was Elizabeth Moberly who coined the term first.
Yeah, well, Moberly was English, of course, and Joseph Nicolosi was from California. And those were books that were used by Evergreen to help us. So we'd go to these weekly support group sessions. I actually only went a few times because I was living in Phoenix going to grad school at the time, and I didn't have time for the weekly sessions. But I went to a couple of devotionals, and then I went to the annual conference in Salt Lake. My very first conference, I was scared to death. I literally was worried that I might pee my pants. I was so scared to show up and be there where other people who, just by my virtue of my presence in this conference, they automatically knew something that I had kept so deeply secret, that I was attracted to men. And it was a cathartic experience too, because you finally get a chance to talk to other people who felt like you and who felt the loneliness. And you kind of touched on it in your introduction, but I felt extremely lonely. I mean, here I was attending BYU, and I already served an honorable mission and never told anybody. And I was at BYU, and, you know, every day I'm walking around and there's thousands and thousands of men walking around, return missionaries. And I have, you know, gym class, and I'm doing everything I can to avert my eyes in the locker rooms, and sitting in religion class and, you know, drooling over the guy who sits next to me, and feeling horrible, and going home and begging God for forgiveness for my feelings. And there was a sense of deep loneliness that I carried for years. And then even after I came out, it was like I no longer belonged in the church, and I didn't really belong in the gay community, because I wasn't, you know, out wearing feathers and rainbow boas, and I didn't really feel like I belonged anywhere. I just continued to have this sense of being alone. And it wasn't until after I'd left my belief in the church in 2008 and accepted that not only was I gay, but I could define for myself what gay meant. I didn't have to subscribe to the church's definition of same-sex attraction, which was kind of a misnomer. And I didn't have to subscribe to what the gay community said that gay was. Gay meant that, you know, I had to flop my arms around or be effeminate in any way. And eventually I realized that gay was a very broad term. And for me, you know, I could still build things in my backyard and be fairly masculine, but also go to the theater and the opera and the ballet and, you know, teach my children how to sew and how to sing. And I have a very sensitive side. And the stereotypes that are associated with being gay really are just that. They're stereotypes. They're not what each individual person is. And when I realized I could be who I was and be gay, but that's only a small definition of who I am, that each one of us as humans is a very complicated, complex human being, that we don't need to stick each other in compartmentalized boxes. It also allowed me to just pull back that sense of angst and loneliness that I had, because I began to feel that I could love myself just the way I was, and that I didn't have to defend myself or explain myself or put myself in a box in order to satisfy somebody else's definitions. Anyway, that was the first thing, was the origins of Evergreen. I wanted to get a little bit more of that out. Also, I wanted to talk a little bit about BYU when I was there. So my freshman year, I was still just a young 18-year-old, and I knew I was depressed. I didn't know what was is about or why. And so I went to the McDonald Health Center, which is where they had counselors. And I walked in, it was the middle of the afternoon. I didn't have an appointment or anything. I just walked in and said, hey, I'd like to talk to a counselor. And they set me up in a small room off to the right with a grad student, and he had a clipboard and he went through his list of, you know, questions, you know, and at some point down the clipboard, he asked if I was or had ever been homosexual. And I paused because I didn't know how to answer that. I'd never had sex with any other man. I didn't know what that word really meant. I mean, I knew what my attractions were when I felt horribly guilty when I was in the locker room or whatever, but I said, maybe. And this grad student didn't even look up from his clipboard. He's like, oh, that's okay. We have a treatment for that. And then he continued on down with the questions. So this was basically an intake interview for a grad student who's going to do counseling therapy on me. And he set me up and he described what the electroshock therapy that was being done. This was in 1981. This was the very last year, by the way, that BYU sanctioned electroshock therapy as part of reparative therapy. For those who aren't familiar, electroshock therapy is only one of a much broader sense of change therapy. So electroshock therapy can be used to change behaviors in other ways, not just homosexuality. So sometimes people confuse those two and get them linked up. And I know you're chomping at the bit there to jump in, Ken. Why don't you do that before I continue?
I just wanted to just project a little bit here, because there's a common misconception that this was only done in BYU. And that's actually not true. It was done in the National Health Service here in the UK for many years.
Oh, it was done in many places, yes. It was done nationally here in the US as well. But BYU was a special case because the LDS Church leadership, who sat on the board of BYU, they approved these treatments and had encouraged this. I mean, Ernest Wilkinson, who was president of BYU in 1965, he gave a devotional, the Tuesday morning devotional, those who are familiar with BYU. And this was at the Smith Field House back before the Marriott Center was completed. And he gave a talk and he basically told all the homosexuals to get up and leave their building. He said, we want all of you to leave BYU. We don't want your presence to contaminate the other BYU students. Now, I didn't know about this because my memory is you know, as a child, but I was 3 years old. My mother was there attending this devotional with my toddler sister, and she was pregnant with my brother, Justin. And so even though years later, when my mother acknowledged that she knew when I was a child that I was a homosexual, that I had those, what she called effeminate tendencies, my parents absorbed those teachings of the leaders of the church at the time. And so anyway, this therapy session ended, and this graduate student made an appointment for me after he had described what the treatment would be at the next meeting. And I went home, and I had so much sweat in my palms, and my heart was racing, and I realized I could never do that. I could never do that. And so I did not show up to that therapy session. And when I didn't show up, the counseling center called my apartment, and my roommates took the calls and left messages for me. Yes, the counseling center, but I never went back. Basically, what that, the fright that caused me forced me to even go deeper into the closet. And so the rest of my time at BYU, I just got even more depressed, because I felt like if I did tell anybody, that not only would I be expelled from school, you know, I'd lose my housing, I'd lose my status in the church. You know, I knew I would have to go home and tell my mother, who was an advocate for, well, at the time she was working for the health department in Salt Lake. And she was involved with the research with what was then called GRID, gay-related immune deficiency. My mother was the head of the STD clinic in Salt Lake, downtown 6th South. And they were tracking all of the men who were coming in with this weird disease. And because the Utah state law at the time required that anybody getting treatment had to divulge the names of their sexual partners and their contact information. So my mother was in the process of collecting and gathering this information, and she'd put it up on a blackboard. Back then they didn't have a whiteboard. And she eventually took a Polaroid of that blackboard, which identified all of the contact names of all these gay men. And she'd come home and she wouldn't really divulge the information that was there, but she would talk about how disgusted she were by all these gay men who were, you know, filling our streets with their disgusting diseases. And I knew that my mother hated gay people. And so I felt like I could never come out. So my sense of feeling lonely was also fueled by the sense that I couldn't tell anybody. I couldn't tell my family. I couldn't, if I told the church, I told the bishop at my BYU, I'd be expelled. And, you know, so this went on for many years. My senior year at BYU was when I finally told the bishop that I thought that I might be homosexual. Again, remember, I had never done anything with a guy, and I wasn't even masturbating. I was such a good little Mormon boy. And this bishop, you know, was so nice that a week later I got a call from the state executive secretary and setting up an appointment with the state president. Now, I thought that because I'd confessed to being homosexual that I was going to be excommunicated. I was still a bit naive about the whole thing. And the state president was L. Tom Perry's son. So they were a big man with a big voice and a big smile. And he came up and he gave me a big old handshake and a hug and said, you know, Brother Curran, your bishop thinks so highly of you, he wants you to be the Elderscorn president. And I was dumbfounded because here I thought I was about to be excommunicated from the church. But so I spent my last year and a half at BYU as the Elderscorn president, just giving deeper into the church and going to the temple on a weekly basis, sitting in the celestial room and tears down my face, just begging God to take a scalpel and cut out this homosexual attraction that I had. So, all right. Finally, I wanted to get back to Evergreen. I know we were supposed to kind of be discussing growing out of Evergreen, but when I was involved with the leadership there, as I said, my mother was on the board, and my future father-in-law, now ex-father-in-law, had also volunteered to be on the board, and they were spending a lot of time with a friend of mine's mother, Vera Eccles. David was also involved with Evergreen, and his mom, Vera, She was the connection that helped fund Evergreen for about 10 years. Pretty much every year, she started with a $25,000 endowment and then worked it up. And at one point, one year, she gave $100,000 to fund Evergreen. Now, the church had refused to do any kind of funding and even have any legal association with it. And of course, by the time that the ex-gay movement had been completely disavowed in the press, the church had pulled away any of their connections. And that was the point where Evergreen finally folded and was the assets, what was left of it, was sold to North Star. So while my mom was the very beginning of this, she had influence with the other board members, the other gay men, and said, look, we need to get a paid position, and we need to get it an executive director who's got some therapeutic experience. And she recommended a man named David Pruden. Now, David Pruden was my family's home teacher for many years when I was a teenager growing up. So I knew him very well. He'd been to my home many, many times, and he was kind, a very kind and a sweet man. And his involvement with Evergreen is because my mother had recommended him as the executive director. And he stayed there for 18 years before he left. He's the kind of man who eventually was called as a bishop out at the Utah State Penitentiary. He cared for the inmates there, and he really was a kind man. But I believe he, like many of us, was duped into this idea that God did not like or did not support homosexuals, and therefore we had to, because God said so, we had to do everything we could to drum it out of us, to teach it out of us, to counsel and therapize and group session and hypnosis and all the things that many of us did. And I guess I need to probably stop rambling for a minute. Ken, so take it over.
Let me just talk a little bit about my experience of coming out of the church, and I guess my struggles with LDS social services. So when I was really, really having a hard time and heading towards this mental breakdown, my ex-wife, well, my wife at the time, and I decided that actually, why don't we, go back to LDS social services and see what they can do to kind of help me get over this this hurdle or this bump in the road that I've come to. So bear in mind, this time going back to LDS social services, I had a bachelor's degree in psychology. So I was very much more equipped to be critical of any research studies that were done on sexual orientation change methods. So when I went back to LDS social services, I asked what evidence they had that they could show me that would demonstrate to me that, if I was going to make another kind of, or take another slice of the pie, that it was going to be worth it. So they presented a journal article to me that was about, successful treatment of homosexuality. And of course, being a little bit more inquisitive this time, I decided to look at the publication. And it was the Journal of the National Association for Research and Treatment of Homosexuality. And straight away, I thought, there's definitely a publication bias here. And kind of each time I came across other information that was presented to me, there was always a bias to it, and I just couldn't go along with it. At this same time, I was kind of thinking, actually, when I had therapy before, what were the things that helped? And one of the things that helped was, enlisting support of a confidant. So my ex-wife and I, we spoke about, who might be available to support me. And there was a man at church who I really got along really well with. And I thought, actually, that he's going to be, really helpful, because I already have a good relationship with him. And I kind of got the sense that he would be okay in terms of me being gay. So I had a conversation with him, and I kind of spoke to him at length around the subject. And then I kind of said, you know, I'm really struggling with something that's really, you know, pretty big. And it's something that I need help with. And the way that I've been taught to kind of get help for this is to enlist support. And I would really like your support with this. And kind of took a big deep breath and said, you know, the problem that I'm having, the reason I'm feeling like this is because I'm attracted to other men. And he kind of just took a big pause and just kind of almost put his head down and said, oh, heck, so am I. And, and you know, it doesn't take a psychologist to work out what might have happened from there. But, you know, that I was just in no position to be able to not follow through on those attractions anymore. I just exhausted myself and exhausted every avenue that I knew of how to change. And this just wasn't going away. And I just felt the last thing that I could do to reach out to someone, to ask for some help and to get that response was, you know, at the time, being a firm believer in God, I really kind of felt that was a real slap in the face. And I felt that was really unfair. And I felt that I'd been tested enough and I was done.
Oh, yes, I relate to those feelings. We could probably go on forever, but I think, Daniel, we need to invite you back to maybe moderate a few questions. Maybe there aren't any questions. Who knows? Have we got any yet?
Yeah, we have a few questions that we can start going through.
Sorry, I just realized my microphone was up by my head. Yeah, we have a few questions. The first question that I have on here, what advice would you offer to church leaders if they were approached by a member who is LGBTQ seeking advice / guidance to help ensure emotional well-being?
Ken, you want to take that, Mr. Therapy?
Yeah. Actually, I would advise them to reach out to Affirmation. There is a lot of people in Affirmation who are at all sorts of places along the spectrum in terms of believing, non-believing, active, inactive, excommunicated. And actually there's a huge pool of resources already about how to have these sorts of conversations with people who are struggling with this kind of thing. One thing that I would very, very, very much caution against is giving anyone the impression that sexuality can change. And that would be very dangerous, in my opinion. I'd be very cautious to ensure that they ask about the mental health and get proper licensed support from someone who is in my country, it doesn't matter because there's practically no Mormon counselors or therapists. I guess it would be, I don't know what the position is in Utah in terms of the proportion of people who may be therapists but who are gay affirmative and Mormon. But I think that would be important to definitely have that. Anything you want to add, Jan?
Yeah, I got a couple things I want to add. First off, I support your statement that the bishop or whoever the church leader is needs to not imply that change is possible. This is something that has caused a lot of pain and grief and suffering for LGBT people. Now, the concept of gay affirming therapists just doesn't exist in LDS family services. And most bishops, in the bishop handbook, it says that they're supposed to refer these LGBT kids to LDS family services. And I would tell this bishop, don't do it. Send the kid to a therapist of their choice and let them do it. If you want to pay for them, that's great. But the idea of an LDS therapist who is more inclined to teach LDS doctrine than to follow the licensing requirements and not therapize or counsel a student or a person to be one way or the other. Basically, a person who comes to a client who comes to a therapist can't be told by a therapist in the United States anyway. I presume it's probably the same in the UK. Cannot be told that you need to change your orientation or let me help you change your orientation, because SAS or sexual orientation change efforts have been deemed by the APA to be damaging and unhelpful. So,
Psychological Association.
Yeah. Another thing, and I don't mean to disparage Ken's opinions, but I personally would not counsel a student to go to affirmation. My experience with affirmation has been a little bit different, because the people that I know in affirmation and the mission of affirmation is to push the idea that homosexuality or gay identity is going to be accepted in the church. And I personally don't believe that's ever going to happen. I don't think the church is ever going to embrace gay people, approve their marriages in the temple. I just don't think that's going to happen. So I think it's a bit of a pipe dream.
Seen that in any of the affirmation literature, actually.
Well, and maybe affirmation has changed today from when I first became associated with it in the late 90s and throughout the 2000s. But
I certainly would not endorse that.
Yeah. Well, I find that affirmation is like Evergreen was for me. It's a good stepping stone for a person who's coming to grips with their own internal struggles and their sexual identity or sexual orientation. It's a place to start to find others who are like-minded, who need to have that association. I think the social aspect is important. But in the end, I guarantee you no bishop or stake president is going to push affirmation, because that's just contrary to what the church's mission is. The church's mission is to suppress sexual orientation, and all sex orientation is heterosexual, and anything outside of that is a sin. And so I don't think that the church leader would be inclined to do that. But to the question that the person was asking, you know, what do you counsel? From my perspective, if you are a person who cares for this member of your flock, then you love them. You accept them where they're at, and do not try to be a therapist to them. Bishops and stake presidents have not been formally trained, do not have the resources and the understanding to do and to conduct therapy on a member of their ward or stake, and they should have no business trying to do that. They should just turn the therapy and counseling over to professionals who are licensed and trained to do so. All right, I'll get off my soapbox.
All right, the next question is, have either of you worked with lawmakers to get conversion therapy banned?
I have here in Utah. I've worked with Equality Utah just as a volunteer. I've shown up at a lot of the sessions that were held, the legislative sessions and hearings. But I don't sit on any formal board, and I don't have any formal interaction with lawmakers, other than that I have personal relationship with my local legislators here in Utah. But I think nationally, there are probably others who have been involved with getting reparative therapy banned. And let me just point out that right now in the United States, thankfully, reparative therapy is now banned for minors, but it's not for adults. And I frankly think it should be banned for adults too, but just like drinking and smoking is legal for adults, if they would like to indulge, that's fine. I still think it's damaging, and reparative therapy to me is just as damaging to a 32-year-old who's emotionally challenged as it is to a 12 or a 16-year-old, and we need to ban this practice.
In the UK, reparative therapy is banned for adults and minors. And
really, for adults as well. Wow.
Yeah. Every professional organization in the UK that accredits mental health care professionals, if that is attempted in any way, then they will be kicked out, basically.
All right. The next question is, what message might you have for an LDS member considering disclosing they are LGBTQ to a teacher or church leader, example, bishop, stake president, or mission president?
Don't do it. Don't disclose. Those people have no business knowing what your personal private information is. There are other resources and other people who are qualified and who genuinely care about you who are not interested in trying to change your orientation.
I think I'd be more interested in the intent to disclose what they would want to happen from that, and then discuss with them what the possibilities might be in terms of their intents being met.
My suspicion is that the question is implying that they're needing help, that they're at that stage where they're ready to start talking about their own sexual orientation and they need help. And my belief is that a bishop and a stake president can't help them with their sexual orientation. And all that will do will imply more guilt because they're not praying enough or they're not fasting enough or they're associating with the wrong people. I mean, I've had bishops, even though I'm no longer LDS, I've had bishops tell me to my face that they're still using the miracle of forgiveness in church leadership and guidance and telling gay people who come to a bishop for help to go back and read the miracle of forgiveness, which in that book is damaging. It's very archaic in its approach to gay people.
Are some Mormon ally groups better than others? Do most do a good job in advocating for LGBTQI people?
Go ahead, Ken.
I mean, in the UK, there really aren't, you know, that many other than Affirmation. I know from my kind of contacts with Affirmation that Affirmation has met with the presiding bishopric, and they've had very positive discussions with them. I think it probably, you know, it only gets to a certain point in which it becomes doctrinally sticky. But I personally think it's good to be at the table to be able to have a conversation rather than not. And from what I read in the, you know, kind of forums and stuff, there's some really great ones depending on your personal circumstances. So, for example, there's a fantastic Facebook page for parents called I'll Walk With You, and that is really inspiring. There's also Mama Dragons for mothers who are advocating for their children, and my ex-wife is actually a member of that now. And it's in Circle House and all that kind of stuff, but I expect Yang would know more about that than I would.
Well, he's mentioned a few good ones. Mama Dragons is a great group for advocating. The question was advocating for LGBT people. And so that implies that it deviates a little bit from LDS doctrine because LDS doctrine does not advocate for LGBT people. Encircle is a good one for youth here in Utah. There's a house in Provo and another one in Salt Lake, and they gathered all kinds of funds to help support LGBT youth who are needing education or even needing a home. For a while there, the Mama Dragons were helping to find temporary housing for a lot of the gay homeless youth here in Utah. I don't know what the extent their reach is outside of Utah. I know that there are some other groups. As it relates to LDS groups, probably the largest one is North Star, which is essentially taken over from Evergreen. I have recently reviewed their web page, and it's just basically the same old stuff that Evergreen did. It's all about the church and staying true to your testimony and your covenants, and frankly, it's in denial of the science and in denial of the reality of what these people experience. And so I don't recommend North Star as an ultimate place to go, but it is like Evergreen was for me. It's a good stepping stone to finding support, finding like-minded people, but it's not in the end going to help a person who is just coming out to embrace themselves fully, because it engenders a continued sense of self loathing and self-judgment that is not helpful psychologically or emotionally healthy. When I was first coming out as a gay father, the Gamophytes group here in Utah was fairly active. And then I helped form another group called Utah Gay Fathers. And that one does not, it accepts a lot of LDS men, but it doesn't define itself by the religion. So it's basically secular in that regards. And so there are, I'd say 90% of the men came from LDS backgrounds, and there's a handful that are still active LDS and even still married, but at least they find other gay fathers that they can associate with and have some understanding and familiarity with. There's a couple of other groups, but I wouldn't qualify them as LDS support groups. I think the Mormons Building Bridges is a great, again, a great stepping stone for that, but I was banned, as many of my gay comrades were, for advocating on their wall on Facebook for equality, and they define themselves as saying they don't want to be a political organization, but the fact is they are a political organization, and they have shown up in pride parades and etc. But it's a good place for active Mormons who want to show their love and support for LGBT people, whether it's someone they know or just they just are that way. But in the end, I think there's a conflict with the whole concept of accepting that 10% of the population is on the LGBTQ spectrum, and Mormon doctrine just does not allow that. Daniel?
Right. Yeah, we have about 3 minutes. Two more questions. We'll see if we get through them or not. If we don't, that's okay. You can go in and write some answers in later. So the next one is, if the possibility of doctrine change within the LDS Church is unlikely or even impossible, what do you see the church being able to offer to those who are LGBTQ?
I don't actually see the church being able to offer anything to people who are LGBTQ, other than a life of loneliness.
I would agree with that statement, Daniel.
All right. Last question then. What message might you give to missionaries teaching LGBTQ people investigating the LDS Church? How can missionaries explain the LDS position to investigators?
I know Kent's got a lot to say about that one. My daughter is right now on a mission in Germany, and she is not at a point where she's willing to discuss with me. After the 2015 policy change was announced, my ex-wife convinced my then teenage kids to disavow me, since the policy required that children not be able to participate in church ordinances until they turn 18 and disavow their same-sex parent. Now, later that policy was amended, and they said, no, we didn't mean disavow the same-sex parent. We just meant disavow the practice of homosexuality. But the damage had already been done. So my kids just sent me texts and disavowed me. It was very, very painful. But now here she is on a mission, and it's been a year and a half, and she hasn't spoken to me until 2 weeks ago. She sent me an email, first one I've heard from her. And basically she's saying that she still doesn't believe that my lifestyle is in accordance with what God wants, and she wouldn't feel safe being around me. And so I don't think she's in a state where she can understand that what she's been taught is wrong. And so the moment you say wrong to somebody who has deep beliefs, they tend to shut down. You can't get them past that. So to get a Mormon missionary who's, you know, now zealously and deeply involved in teaching the church to share the gospel with an LGBT person, I think unless they have love as their a guiding principle, they're just not going to be successful with that. Ken?
Daniel, can you read the question again, please?
Yeah. Sorry, let me pull that. Yeah, what message might you give to missionaries teaching LGBTQ people investigating the LDS Church? How can missionaries explain the LDS position to investigators?
Well, I don't think that the missionaries, I mean, you know, I really feel for the position that, that these young people are in, mostly young people, because they've been brought up in the system and they are only taught to look at things in one way. And, you know, when they are out into the big wild world where their positions are going to be challenged, they're likely just become polarized. I don't think that it's possible really for the for missionaries to effectively teach the complexities of the human experience, and that's a spectrum of sexuality, at such a young age and with such limited lived experience themselves. I think it's an impossible task, and I think they'd fail miserably in the light of most people who would be LGBT affirming. They'd probably receive a round of applause from people who aren't.
Wonderful. Thank you both for everything that you've talked about today. There is another question in there, but we do have to end the session right now so we can continue this conversation in the Huva Hap. But thank you both for everything that you've talked about and for everyone who has attended today and for supporting Sunstone. We'll see you all in other sessions.
Thank you, Daniel. Thanks, Ken.